He looked quickly at his son, almost snatching the glance as a shoplifter might take a small but fairly valuable item and tuck it into his coat, then went back to minding the cracks in the sidewalk again. They were now walking down Castle Hill and towards the town's single signal light at the crossing of Lower Main Street and Watermill Lane. Beyond the intersection, what locals called the Tin Bridge, crossed Castle Stream. Its overstructure cut the deep blue autumn sky into neat geometrical shapes. I guess it's that feeling, that special sureness that infects the poor souls who lose their bank accounts, their houses, their cars, even the clothes they stand up in at casinos and backroom poker games. That feeling that you got a telegram from God. I only got it that once, and I thank God for that. In those days, I'd make a friendly bet on a football game or the World Series with somebody. $5 was the most, I think, and usually it was a lot less than that. Just a token thing, a quarter, or maybe a pack of cigarettes. This time it was Kevin who shoplifted a glance. Only Mr. Delavan caught it. Cracks in the sidewalk or no cracks. Yes, I smoked in those days, too. Now I don't smoke and I don't bet. Not since that last one. That last one cured me. Back then, your mother and I had only been married 2 years. You weren't born yet. I was working as a surveyor's assistant, bringing home just about $116 a week. Or that was what I cleared, anyway, when the government finally let go of it. This fellow, who was so proud of the Celtics, was one of the engineers. He even wore one of those green Celtics warm-up jackets to work, the kind that had the shamrock on the back. The week before the playoffs, he kept saying he'd like to find someone brave enough and stupid enough to bet on the 76ers because he had $400 just waiting to catch him a dividend. That voice inside me kept getting louder and louder. And the day before the championship series started, I went up to him on lunch break. My heart felt like it was going to tear right out of my chest. I was so scared. "Because you didn't have $400?" Kevin said. "The other guy did, but you didn't." He was looking at his father openly now, the camera completely forgotten for the first time since his first visit to Pop Merrill. The wonder of what the Sun 660 was doing was lost, temporarily anyway, in this newer, brighter wonder. As a young man, his father had done something spectacularly stupid, just as Kevin knew other men did, just as he might do himself someday when he was on his own and there was no adult member of the reasonable tribe to protect him from some terrible impulse, some misbegotten instinct. His father, it seemed, had briefly been a member of the instinctive tribe himself. It was hard to believe, but wasn't this the proof?
Right.
But you bet him.
Not right away, his father said. I told him I thought the 76ers would take the championship, but $400 was a lot to risk for a guy who was only a surveyor's assistant.
But you never came right out and told him you didn't have the money.
I'm afraid it went a little further than that, Kevin. I implied I did have it. I said I couldn't afford to lose $400, and that was disingenuous, to say the least. I told him I couldn't risk that kind of money on an even bet. Still not lying, you see, but skating right up to the edge of the lie.
Do you see?
Yes. I don't know what would have happened. Maybe nothing, if the foreman hadn't rung the back-to-work bell right then. But he did, and this engineer threw up his hands and said, "I'll give you 2-1, sonny, if that's what you want. It don't matter to me. It's still going to be 400 in my pocket." And before I knew what was happening, we'd shook on it, with half a dozen men watching. And I was in the soup, for better or worse. And going home that night, I thought of your mother, what she'd say if she knew. And I pulled over to the shoulder of the road in the old Ford I had back then, and I puked out the door. A police car came rolling slowly down Harrington Street. Norris Ridgwick was driving, and Andy Clutterbuck was riding shotgun. Clut raised his hand as the cruiser turned left on Main Street. John and Kevin Delavan raised their hands in return, and autumn drowsed peacefully around them, as if John Delavan had never sat in the open door of his old Ford and puked into the road dust between his own feet. They crossed Main Street.
Well, you could say I got my money's worth anyway. The Sixers took it right to the last few seconds of the seventh game. Then one of those Irish bastards, I forget which one it was, stole the ball from Hal Greer and went to the hole with it. And there went the $400 I didn't have. When I paid that goddamn engineer off the next day, he said, "Got a little nervous there near the end." That was all. I could have popped his eyes out with my thumbs.
You paid him off the next day? How'd you do that?
I told you, it was like a fever. Once we shook hands on the bet, the fever passed. I hoped like hell I'd win that bet, but I knew I'd have to think like I was going to lose. There was a lot more at stake than just $400. There was the question of my job, of course, and what might happen if I wasn't able to pay off the guy I'd bet with. He was an engineer, after all, and technically my boss. That fellow had just enough son-of-a-bitch in him to have fired my ass if I didn't pay the wager. It wouldn't have been the bet, but he would have found something, and it would have been something that would go on my work record in big red letters, too. But that wasn't the biggest thing, not at all.
What was?
Your mother. Our marriage. When you're young and don't have either a pot to piss in or a window to throw it out of, a marriage is under strain all the time. It doesn't matter how much you love each other. That marriage is like an overloaded pack horse, and you know it can fall to its knees or even roll over dead if all the wrong things happen at all the wrong times. I don't think she would have divorced me over a $400 bet, but I'm glad I never had to find out for sure. So when the fever passed, I saw that I might have bet a little more than $400. I might just have bet my whole goddamn future. They were approaching the Emporium Galorium. There was a bench on the verge of the grassy town common, and Mr. Delavan gestured for Kevin to sit down. "This won't take long," he said, and then laughed. It was a grating, compressed sound, like an inexperienced driver working a transmission lever. It hurts too much to stretch out even after all these years. So they sat on the bench, and Mr. Delavan finished the story of how he happened to know Pop Merrill, while they looked across the grassy common with the bandstand in the middle. "I went to him the same night I made the bet," he said. "I told your mother I was going out for cigarettes. I went after dark so no one would see me. From town, I mean. They would have known I was in some kind of trouble, and I didn't want that. I went in, and Pop said, 'What's a professional man like you doing in a place like this, Mr. John Delavan?' I told him what I'd done, and he said, 'You made a bet, and already you've got your head set to the idea you've lost it?' 'If I do lose it,' I said, 'I want to make sure I don't lose anything else.' That made him laugh. 'I respect a wise man,' he said. 'I reckon I can trust you. If the Celtics win, you come see me. I'll take care of you. You've got an honest face.'"
"And that was all?" Kevin asked.
In eighth grade math, they had done a unit on loans, and he still remembered most of it.
"He didn't ask for any, collateral?"
"People who go to Pop don't have collateral," his father said. "He's not a loan shark like you see in the movies. He doesn't break any legs if you don't pay up. But he has ways of fixing people."
"What ways?"
"Never mind," John Delavan said. "After that last game ended, I went upstairs to tell your mother I was going out for cigarettes. Again. She was asleep, though, so I was spared that lie. It was late for Castle Rock, anyway, going on 11, but the lights were on in his place. I knew they would be. He gave me the money in tens. He took them out of an old Crisco can. All tens. I remember that. They were crumpled, but he had made them straight. 40 $10 bills. Him counting them out like a bank clerk, with that pipe going and his glasses up on his head. And for just a second there, I felt like knocking his teeth out. Instead, I thanked him. You don't know how hard it can be to say thank you sometimes. I hope you never do." He said,
"You understand the terms now, don't you?"
And I said I did. And he said,
"That's good. I ain't worried about you. What I mean to say is you got an honest face. You go on and take care of your business with that fella at work. And then take care of your business with me. And don't make any more bets. Man only has to look in your face to see you weren't cut out to be a gambler."
So I took the money and went home and put it under the floor mat of the old Chevy and lay next to your mother and didn't sleep a wink all night long because I felt filthy. Next day, I gave the tens to the engineer I bet with, and he counted them out. And then he just folded them over and tucked them into one of his shirt pockets and buttoned the flap. Like that cash didn't mean any more than a gas receipt he'd have to turn into the chief contractor at the end of the day. Then he clapped me on the shoulder and said, "Well, you're a good man, Johnny. Better than I thought. I won 400, but I lost 20 to Bill Untermeyer. He bet you'd come up with the dough first thing this morning, and I bet him I wouldn't see it till the end of the week if I ever did." "I pay my debts," I said. "Easy now," he said, and clapped me on the shoulder again. And I think that time I really did come close to popping his eyeballs out with my thumbs. "How much interest did Pop charge you, Dad?" His father looked at him sharply. "Does he let you call him that?"
"Yeah, why?"
"Watch out for him, then," Mr. Delavan said. "He's a snake." Then he sighed, as if admitting to both of them that he was begging the question and knew it. 10%, that's what the interest was.
"That's not so much."
"Compounded weekly," Mr. Delavan added. Kevin sat struck dumb for a moment. Then,
"But that's not legal."
"How true," Mr. Delavan said dryly. He looked at the strained expression of incredulity on his son's face, and his own strained look broke. He laughed and clapped his son on the shoulder. "It's only the world, Kev," he said. "It kills us all in the end, anyhow."
But
nothing. That was the freight, and he knew I'd pay it. I knew they were hiring on the 3-to-11 shift at the mill over in Oxford. I told you I'd gotten myself ready to lose, and going to Pop wasn't the only thing I did. I'd talked to your mother, said I might take a shift over there for a while. After all, she'd been wanting a newer car, and maybe to move to a better apartment and get a little something into the bank in case we had some kind of financial setback. He laughed. Well, the financial setback had happened, and she didn't know it, and I meant to do my damnedest to keep her from finding out. I didn't know if I could or not. I meant to do my damnedest. She was dead set against it. She said I'd kill myself working 16 hours a day. She said those mills were dangerous. You were always reading about someone losing an arm or a leg or even getting crushed to death under the rollers. I told her not to worry. I'd get a job in the sorting room, minimum wage, but sit-down work. And if it really was too much, I'd give it up. She was still against it. She said she'd go to work herself, but I talked her out of that. That was the last thing I wanted, you know? Kevin nodded. I told her I'd quit 6 months, 8 at the outside anyway. So I went up and they hired me on, but not in the sorting room. I got a job in the rolling shed, feeding raw stock into a machine that looked like the wringer on a giant's washing machine. It was dangerous work, all right, if you slipped or if your attention wandered, and it was hard to keep that from happening because it was so damn monotonous. You'd lose part of yourself or all of it. I saw a man lose his hand in a roller once, and I never want to see anything like that again. It was like watching a charge of dynamite go off in a rubber glove stuffed with meat.
"God damn,"
Kevin said. He had rarely said that in his father's presence, but his father did not seem to notice. "Anyway, I got $2.80 an hour, and after 2 months, they bumped me up to $3.10, he said. It was hell. I'd work on the road project all day long. At least it was early spring and not hot. And then race off to the mill, pushing that Chevy for all it was worth to keep from being late. I'd take off my khakis and just about jump into a pair of blue jeans and a T-shirt and work the rollers from 3 to 11. I'd get home around midnight. And the worst part was the nights when your mother waited up, which she did 2 or 3 nights a week. And I'd have to act cheery and full of pep. When I could hardly walk a straight line, I was so tired. But if she'd seen that, she would have made you stop." "Yes, she would. So I'd act bright and chipper and tell her funny stories about the sorting room where I wasn't working, and sometimes I'd wonder what would happen if she ever decided to drive up some night to give me a hot dinner or something like that. I did a pretty good job, but some of it must have showed, because she kept telling me I was silly to be knocking myself out for so little. And it really did seem like chicken feed once the government dipped their beak and Pop dipped his. It seemed like just about what a fellow working in the sorting room for minimum wage would clear. They paid Wednesday afternoons, and I always made sure to cash my check in the office before the girls went home. Your mother never saw one of those checks. The first week I paid Pop $50. 40 was interest, and 10 was on the 400, which left 390 owing,
I was like a walking zombie. On the road, I'd sit in my car at lunch, eat my sandwich, and then sleep until the foreman rang his goddamn bell. I hated that bell. I paid him $50 the second week. 39 was interest, 11 was on the principal. And I had it down to $379. I felt like a bird trying to eat a mountain one peck at a time. The third week, I almost went into the roller myself, and it scared me so bad I woke up for a few minutes. Enough to have an idea, anyway. So I guess it was a blessing in disguise. I had to give up smoking. I couldn't understand why I hadn't seen it before. In those days, a pack of smokes cost 40 cents. I smoked two packs a day. That was $5.60 a week. We had a cigarette break every 2 hours, and I looked at my pack of Carrington's and saw I had 10, maybe 12. I made those cigarettes last a week and a half, and I never bought another pack. I spent a month not knowing if I could make it or not. There were days when the alarm went off at 6 o'clock, and I knew I couldn't, that I'd just have to tell Mary and take whatever she wanted to dish out. But by the time the second month started, I knew I was probably going to be all right. I think to this day it was the extra $5.60 a week, that and all the returnable beer and soda bottles I could pick up along the sides of the road, that made the difference. I had the principal down to $300. That meant I could knock off $25, $26 a week from it, more as time went on. Then in late April, we finished the road project and got a week off, with pay. I told Mary I was getting ready to quit my job at the mill, and she said, thank God. And I spent that week off from my regular job, working all the hours I could get at the mill, because it was time and a half. I never had an accident. I saw them. Saw men fresher and more awake than I was have them. But I never did. I don't know why. At the end of that week, I gave Pop Merrill $100 and gave my week's notice at the paper mill. After that last week, I had whittled the nut down enough so I could chip the rest off my regular paycheck without your mother noticing. He fetched a deep sigh. Now you know how I know Pop Merrill and why I don't trust him. I spent 10 weeks in hell, and he reaped the sweat off my forehead and my ass, too, in $10 bills that he undoubtedly took out of that Crisco can or another one and passed on to some other sad sack who had gotten himself in the same kind of mess I did. Boy, you must hate him. No, Mr. Delavan said, getting up. I don't hate him, and I don't hate myself. I got a fever, that's all. It could have been worse. My marriage could have died of it. And you and Meg never would have been born, Kevin. Or I might have died of it myself. Pop Merrill was the cure. He was a hard cure, but he worked. What's hard to forgive is how he worked. He took every damned cent and wrote it down in a book in a drawer under his cash register and looked at the circles under my eyes and the way my pants had gotten away of hanging off my hip bones, and he said nothing. They walked toward the Emporium Glorium, which was painted the dusty, faded yellow of signs left too long in country store windows. Its false front, both obvious and unapologetic. Next to it, Polly Chalmers was sweeping her walk and talking to Alan Pangborn, the county sheriff. She looked young and fresh with her hair pulled back in a horsetail. He looked young and heroic in his neatly pressed uniform. But things were not always the way they looked. Even Kevin, at 15, knew that. Sheriff Pangborn had lost his wife and youngest son in a car accident that spring, and Kevin had heard that Ms. Chalmers, young or not, had a bad case of arthritis and might be crippled up with it before too many more years passed. Things were not always the way they looked. This thought caused him to glance toward the Emporium Glorium again, and then to look down at his birthday camera, which he was carrying in his hand. He even did me a favor, Mr. Delavan mused. He got me to quit smoking. But I don't trust him. Walk careful around him, Kevin. And no matter what, let me do the talking. I might know him a little better now. So they went into the dusty, ticking silence, where Pop Merrill waited for them by the door, with his glasses propped on the bald dome of his head and a trick or two still up his sleeve.
"Well, then, here you are, father and son,"
Pop said, giving them an admiring, grandfatherly smile. His eyes twinkled behind a haze of pipe smoke, and for a moment Although he was clean-shaven, Kevin thought Pop looked like Father Christmas.
"You've got a fine boy, Mr. Delavan. Fine."
"I know," Mr. Delavan said. "I was upset when I heard he'd been dealing with you because I want him to stay that way."
"That's hard,"
Pop said with the faintest touch of reproach.
"That's hard coming from a man who, when he had nowhere else to turn..."
"That's over," Mr. Delavan said.
Yeah, that's just what I mean to say."
"But this isn't."
"It will be,"
Pop said. He held a hand out to Kevin, and Kevin gave him the sun camera.
"It will be today."
He held the camera up, turning it over in his hands.
"This is a piece of work. What kind of piece? I don't know. But your boy wants to smash it because he thinks it's dangerous. I think he's right. But I told him, you don't want your daddy to think you're a sissy, do you? That's the only reason I had him hoe you down here, John."
I liked Mr. Delavan better.
"All right,"
Pop said and sighed.
"I can see you ain't gonna warm up none and let bygones be bygones."
"No." Kevin looked from one man to the other, his face distressed.
"Well, it don't matter,"
Pop said. Both his voice and face went cold with remarkable suddenness, and he didn't look like Father Christmas at all.
"When I said the past is past and what's done is done, I meant it. Except when it affects what people do in the here and now. But I'm going to say this, Mr. Delavan. I don't bottom deal, and you know it."
Pop delivered this magnificent lie with such flat coldness that both of them believed it. Mr. Delavan even felt a little ashamed of himself, as incredible as that was.
"Our business was our business. You told me what you wanted. I told you what I'd have to have in return. And you give it to me, and there was an end to it. This is another thing."
And then Pop told a lie even more magnificent, a lie which was simply too towering to be disbelieved.
"I got no stake in this, Mr. Delavan. There is nothing I want but to help your boy. I like him."
He smiled, and Father Christmas was back so fast and strong that Kevin forgot he had ever been gone. Yet more than this, John Delavan, who had for months worked himself to the edge of exhaustion and perhaps even death between the rollers in order to pay the exorbitant price this man demanded to atone for a momentary lapse into insanity, John Delavan forgot that other expression too. Pop led them along the twisting aisles, through the smell of dead newsprint, and past the tick-tock clocks, and he put the Sun 660 casually down on the work table, a little too near the edge, just as Kevin had done in his own house after taking that first picture, and then just went on toward the stairs at the back which led up to his little apartment. There was a dusty old mirror propped against the wall back there, and Pop looked into it, watching to see if the boy or his father would pick the camera up or move it further away from the edge. He didn't think either would, but it was possible. They spared it not so much as a passing glance, and as Pop led them up the narrow stairway with the ancient eroded rubber treads, he grinned in a way it would have been bad business for anyone to see, and thought,
"Damn, I'm good."
He opened the door, and they went into the apartment. Neither John nor Kevin Delavan had ever been in Pop's private quarters, and John knew of no one who had. In a way, this was not surprising. No one was ever going to nominate Pop as the town's number one citizen. John thought it was not impossible that the old fuck had a friend or two. The world never exhausted its oddities, it seemed, but if so, he didn't know who they were. And Kevin spared a fleeting thought for Mr. Baker, his favorite teacher. He wondered if, perchance, Mr. Baker had ever gotten into the sort of crack he'd need a fellow like Pop to get him out of. This seemed as unlikely to him as the idea of Pop having friends seemed to his father. But then, an hour ago, the idea that his own father... Well, it was best let go, perhaps. Pop did have a friend, or at least an acquaintance, or two, but he didn't bring them here. He didn't want to. It was his place, and it came closer to revealing his true nature than he wanted anyone to see. It struggled to be neat and couldn't get there. The wallpaper was marked with water stains. They weren't glaring, but stealthy and brown, like the phantom thoughts that trouble anxious minds. There were crusty dishes in the old-fashioned deep sink, and although the table was clean and the lid on the plastic waste can was shut, there was an odor of sardines and something else, unwashed feet maybe, which was almost not there, an odor as stealthy as the water stains on the wallpaper. The living room was tiny. Here the smell was not of sardines and, maybe, feet, but of old pipe smoke. Two windows looked out on nothing more scenic than the alley that ran behind Mulberry Street, and while their panes showed some signs of having been washed, at least swiped at occasionally, the corners were bleared and greasy, with years of condensed smoke. The whole place had an air of nasty things swept under the faded hooked rugs and hidden beneath the old-fashioned, overstuffed easy chair and sofa. Both of these articles were light green, and your eye wanted to tell you they matched but couldn't, because they didn't. Not quite. The only new things in the room were a large Mitsubishi television with a 25-inch screen and a VCR on the end table beside it. To the left of the end table was a rack which caught Kevin's eye because it was totally empty. Pop had thought it best to put the better than 70 fuck movies he owned in the closet for the time being. One video cassette rested on top of the television in an unmarked case.
"Sit down,"
Pop said, gesturing at the lumpy couch. He went over to the TV and slipped the cassette out of its case. Mr. Delavan looked at the couch with a momentary expression of doubt, as if he thought it might have bugs, and then sat down gingerly. Kevin sat beside him. The fear was back, stronger than ever. Pop turned on the VCR, slid the cassette in, and then pushed the carriage down.
"I know a fellow up the city,"
he began. To residents of Castle Rock and its neighboring towns, up the city always meant Lewiston.
"Who's run a camera store for 20 years or so. He got into this VCR business as soon as it started up. Said it was going to be the wave of the future. He wanted me to go halves with him, but I thought he was nuts. Well, I was wrong on that one, is what I mean to say, but..."
"Get to the point," Kevin's father said.
"I'm trying,"
Pop said, wide-eyed and injured.
"If you'll let me..."
Kevin pushed his elbow gently against his father's side, and Mr. Delavan said no more.
"Anyway, a couple of years ago, he found out renting tapes for folks to watch wasn't the only way to make money with these gadgets. If you was willing to lay out as little as $800, you could take people's movies and snapshots and put them on a tape for them. Lots easier to watch."
Kevin made a little involuntary noise, and Pop smiled and nodded.
"Well, you took 58 pictures with that camera of yours, and we all saw each one was a little different than the last one. And I guess we knew what it meant, but I wanted to see for myself. You don't have to be from Missouri to say, 'Show me,' is what I mean to say."
"You tried to make a movie out of those snapshots?" Mr. Delavan asked.
"Didn't try,"
Pop said.
"Did. Or rather, the feller I know up the city did. But it was my idea."
"Is it a movie?" Kevin asked. He understood what Pop had done, and part of him was even chagrined that he hadn't thought of it himself. But mostly, he was awash in wonder and delight at the idea.
"Look for yourself,"
Pop said, and turned on the TV.
58 pictures. When this fella does snapshots for folks, he generally videotapes each one for 5 seconds. Long enough to get a good look, he says, but not long enough to get bored before you go on to the next one. I told him I wanted each of these on for just a single second, and to run them right together with no fades."
Kevin remembered a game he used to play in grade school when he had finished some lesson and had free time before the next one began. He had a little dime pad of paper, which was called a rainbow school pad, because there would be 30 pages of little yellow sheets, then 30 pages of little pink sheets, then 30 pages of green, and so on. To play the game, you went to the very last page, and at the bottom you drew a stick man wearing baggy shorts and holding his arms out. On the next page, you drew the same stick man in the same place and wearing the same baggy shorts, only this time you drew his arms further up, but just a little bit. You did that on every page until the arms came together over the stick man's head. Then, if you still had time, you went on drawing the stick man, but now with the arms going down. And if you flipped the pages very fast when you were done, you had a crude sort of cartoon which showed a boxer celebrating a KO. He raised his hands over his head, clasped them, shook them, lowered them. He shivered. His father looked at him. Kevin shook his head and murmured, "Nothing."
"So what I mean to say is the tape only runs about a minute,"
Pop said.
"You got to look close. Ready?"
"No," Kevin thought.
"I guess so," Mr. Delavan said.
He was still trying to sound grumpy and put out, but Kevin could tell he had gotten interested in spite of himself.
"Okay,"
Pop Merrill said, and pushed the play button. Kevin told himself over and over again that it was stupid to feel scared. He told himself this, and it didn't do a single bit of good. He knew what he was going to see, because he and Meg had both noticed the sun was doing something besides simply reproducing the same image over and over, like a photocopier. It did not take long for them to realize that the photographs were expressing movement from one to the next.
"Look," Meg had said. "The dog's moving."
Instead of responding with one of the friendly but irritating wisecracks he usually reserved for his little sister, Kevin had said,
"It does look like it, but you can't tell for sure, Meg."
"Yes, you can,"
she said. They were in his room, where he had been morosely looking at the camera. It sat on the middle of his desk with his new schoolbooks, which he had been meaning to cover, pushed to one side. Meg had bent the gooseneck of his study lamp so it shone a bright circle of light on the middle of his desk blotter. She moved the camera aside and put the first picture, the one with the dab of cake frosting on it, in the center of the light.
"Count the fence posts between the dogs behind and the right-hand edge of the picture," she said.
"Those are pickets, not fence posts," he told her,
"like what you do when your nose goes on strike."
"Ha ha, count them." He did. He could see four and part of a fifth, although the dog's scraggly hindquarters obscured most of that one.
"Now look at this one."
She put the fourth Polaroid in front of him. Now he could see all of the fifth picket and part of the sixth. So he knew, or believed, he was going to see a cross between a very old cartoon and one of those flipbooks he used to make in grammar school when the time weighed heavy on his hands. The last 25 seconds of the tape were indeed like that, although, Kevin thought, the flipbooks he had drawn in the second grade were really better, the perceived action of the boxer raising and lowering his hands smoother. In the last 25 seconds of the videotape, the action moved in rams and jerks, which made the old Keystone Cop silent films look like marvels of modern filmmaking in comparison. Still, the key word was action, and it held all of them, even Pop, spellbound. They watched the minute of footage three times without saying a word. There was no sound but breathing. Kevin's fast and smooth through his nose, his father's deeper, Pop's a phlegmy rattle in his narrow chest. And the first 30 seconds or so. He had expected action, he supposed. There was action in the flipbooks, and there was action in the Saturday morning cartoons, which were just a slightly more sophisticated version of the flipbooks. But what he had not expected was that for the first 30 seconds of the tape, it wasn't like watching notebook pages rapidly thumbed, or even a primitive cartoon like Possible Possum on TV. For 30 seconds, 28 anyway, his single Polaroid photographs looked eerily like a real movie. Not a Hollywood movie, of course, not even a low-budget horror movie of the sort Megan sometimes pestered him to rent for their own VCR when their mother and father went out for the evening. It was more like a snippet of home movie made by someone who has just gotten an 8mm camera and doesn't know how to use it very well yet. In those first 28 seconds, the black, no-breed dog walked with barely perceptible jerks along the fence, exposing 5, 6, 7 pickets. It even paused to sniff a second time at one of them, apparently reading another one of those canine telegrams. Then it walked on, head down and toward the fence, hindquarters switched out toward the camera. And halfway through this first part, Kevin noted something else he hadn't seen before. The photographer had apparently swung his camera to keep the dog in the frame. If he, or she, hadn't done so, the dog would have simply walked out of the picture, leaving nothing to look at but the fence. The pickets at the far right of the first two or three photographs disappeared behind the right-hand border of the picture, and new pickets appeared at the left. You could tell because the tip of one of those two rightmost pickets had been broken off, Now it was no longer in the frame. The dog started to sniff again. Then its head came up. Its good ear stiffened. The one which had been slashed and laid limp in some long-ago fight tried to do the same. There was no sound. But Kevin felt with a certainty beyond repudiation that the dog had begun to growl. The dog had sensed something or someone. What or who? Kevin looked at the shadow they had first dismissed as the branch of a tree or maybe a phone pole and knew. Its head began to turn. And that was when the second half of this strange film began. 30 seconds of snap-jerk action that made your head ache and your eyeballs hot. Pop had had a hunch, Kevin thought. Or maybe he had even read about something like this before. Either way, it had proved out and was too obvious to need stating. With the pictures taken quite closely together, if not exactly one after the other, the action in the makeshift movie almost flowed. Not quite, but almost. But when the time between the photographs was spaced, what they were watching became something that nauseated your eye because it wanted to see either a moving picture or a series of still photographs, and instead, it saw both and neither. Time was passing in that flat Polaroid world. Not at the same speed it passed in this real one, or the sun would have come up or gone down over there 3 times already. And whatever the dog was going to do would be done if it had something to do. And if it did not, it would just be gone. And there would be only the moveless, seemingly eternal, eroded picket fence guarding the listless patch of lawn. But it was passing. The dog's head was coming around to face the photographer, owner of the shadow, like the head of a dog in the grip of a fit. At one moment, the face and even the shape of the head was obscured by that floppy ear. Then you saw one black-brown eye enclosed by a round and somehow mucky corona that made Kevin think of a spoiled egg white. Then you saw half the muzzle with the lips appearing slightly wrinkled as if the dog were getting ready to bark or growl. And last of all, you saw 3/4 of a face, somehow more awful than the face of any mere dog had a right to be, even a mean one. The white spackles along its muzzle suggested it was no longer young. At the very end of the tape, you saw the dog's lips were indeed pulling back. There was only one blink of white. Kevin thought it was a tooth. He didn't see that until the 3rd run-through. It was the eye that held him. It was homicidal. This breedless dog almost screamed rogue. And it was nameless. He knew that as well. He knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that no Polaroid man or Polaroid woman or Polaroid child had ever named that Polaroid dog. It was a stray, born stray, raised stray, grown old and mean stray, the avatar of all the dogs who had ever wandered the world, unnamed and unhomed, killing chickens, eating garbage out of the cans they had long since learned to knock over, sleeping in culverts and beneath the porches of deserted houses. Its wits would be dim, but its instincts would be sharp and red. It... When Pop Merrill spoke, Kevin was so deeply and fundamentally startled out of his thoughts that he nearly screamed.
"The man who took those pictures," he said, "if there was a person, is what I mean to say, what do you suppose happened to him?"
Pop had frozen the last frame with his remote control. A line of static ran through the picture. Kevin wished it ran through the dog's eye, but the line was below it. That eye stared out at them, baleful, stupidly murderous. No, not stupidly, not entirely. That was what made it not merely frightening, but terrifying. And no one needed to answer Pop's question. You needed no more pictures to understand what was going to happen next. The dog had perhaps heard something. Of course it had. And Kevin knew what. It had heard that squidgy little whine. Further pictures would show it continuing to turn, and then beginning to fill more and more of each frame, until there was nothing to see but dog. No listless, patchy lawn, no fence, no sidewalk, no shadow, just the dog. Who meant to attack? Who meant to kill if it could? Kevin's dry voice seemed to be coming from someone else. "I don't think it likes getting its picture taken," he said. Pop's short laugh was like a bunch of dry twigs broken over a knee for kindling.
Rewind it, Mr. Delman said.
You want to see the whole thing again?
Pop asked.
No, just the last 10 seconds or so.
Pop used the remote control to go back, then ran it again. The dog turned its head, as jerky as a robot which is old and running down but still dangerous. And Kevin wanted to tell them, stop now, just stop, that's enough, just stop, and let's break the camera. Because there was something else, wasn't there? Something he didn't want to think about, but soon would. Like it or not, he could feel it breaching in his mind, like the broad back of a whale.
Once more, Mr. Delavan said. Frame by frame, this time. Can you do that?
Yeah, Pop said. Goddamn machine does everything but the laundry.
This time, one frame, one picture at a time. It was not like a robot now. Or not exactly, but like some weird clock. Something that belonged with Pop's other specimens downstairs. Jerk, jerk, jerk. The head coming around. Soon they would be faced by that merciless, not quite idiotic eye again.
What's that? Mr. Delavan asked.
What's what?
Pop asked, as if he didn't know it was the thing the boy hadn't wanted to talk about the other day, the thing, he was convinced, that made up the boy's mind about destroying the camera once and for all.
Underneath its neck, Mr. Delavan said, and pointed. It's not wearing a collar or a tag, but it's got something around its neck on a string or thin rope.
I don't know, Pop said imperturbably. Maybe a boy does. Young folks have sharper eyes than us old fellas.
Mr. Delavan turned to look at Kevin. Can you make it out? He fell silent. It's really small. His mind returned to what his father had said when they were leaving the house. If she never asks you, you never have to tell her. That's just the way we do things in the grown-up world. Just now, he had asked Kevin if he could make out what that thing under the dog's neck was. Kevin hadn't really answered that question. He had said something else altogether. It's really small. And it was. The fact that he knew what it was, in spite of that, well, what had his father called it, skating up to the edge of a lie? And he couldn't actually see it, not actually. Just the same, he knew. The eye only suggested. The heart understood. Just as his heart understood that, if he was right, the camera must be destroyed. Must be. At that moment, Pop Merrill was suddenly struck by an agreeable inspiration. He got up and snapped off the TV.
I've got the pictures downstairs, he said. Brought them back with the videotape. I seen that thing myself, and ran my magnifying glass over it, but still couldn't tell. But it does look familiar. God cuss it. Just let me go get the pictures in my glass.
We might as well go down with you, Kevin said. Which was the last thing in the world Pop wanted. But then Delavan stepped in, God bless him, and said he might like to look at the tape again after they looked at the last couple of pictures under the magnifying glass.
Won't take a minute,
Pop said, and was gone, sprightly as a bird hopping from twig to twig on an apple tree, before either of them could have protested, if either had had a mind to. Kevin did not. That thought had finally breached its monstrous back in his mind, and like it or not, he was forced to contemplate it. It was simple, as a whale's back is simple, at least to the eye of one who does not study whales for a living, and it was colossal in the same way. It wasn't an idea, but a simple certainty. It had to do with that odd flatness Polaroids always seemed to have, with the way they showed you things only in two dimensions. Although all photographs did that, it was that other photographs seemed to at least suggest a third dimension, even those taken with a simple Kodak 110. The things in his photographs, photographs which showed things he had never seen through the sun's viewfinder, or anywhere else for that matter, were that same way, flatly, unapologetically two-dimensional, except for the dog. The dog wasn't flat. The dog wasn't meaningless, a thing you could recognize, but which had no emotional impact. The dog not only seemed to suggest three dimensions, but to really have them, the way a hologram seems to really have them, or one of those 3D movies where you had to wear special glasses to reconcile the double images.
It's not a Polaroid dog, Kevin thought. And it doesn't belong in the world Polaroids take pictures of. That's crazy. I know it is. But I also know it's true. So what does it mean? Why is my camera taking pictures of it over and over? And what Polaroid man or Polaroid woman is snapping pictures of it? Does he or she even see it? If it is a three-dimensional dog in a two-dimensional world, maybe he or she doesn't see it, can't see it. They say for us time is the fourth dimension, and we know it's there, but we can't see it. We can't even really feel it pass, although sometimes, especially when we're bored, I guess it seems like we can.
But when you got right down to it, all that might not even matter, and the questions were far too tough for him anyway. There were other questions that seemed more important to him, vital questions, maybe even mortal ones. Like, why was the dog in his camera? Did it want something of him or just anybody? At first, he had thought the answer was anybody. Anybody would do because anybody could take pictures of it, and the movement always advanced. But the thing around its neck, that thing that wasn't a collar, that had to do with him, Kevin Delavan, and nobody else. Did it want to do something to him? If the answer to that question was yes, you could forget all the other ones, because it was pretty goddamn obvious what the dog wanted to do. It was in its murky eye, in the snarl you could just see beginning. He thought it wanted two things. First, to escape. Then, to kill. There's a man or woman over there with a camera who maybe doesn't even see that dog, Kevin thought. And if the photographer can't see the dog, maybe the dog can't see the photographer, and so the photographer is safe. But if the dog really is three-dimensional, maybe he sees out. Maybe he sees whoever is using my camera. Maybe it's still not me, or not specifically me. Maybe whoever is using the camera is its target. Still, the thing it was wearing around its neck, what about that?